Welcome to Illinois Family Spotlight, a conversation about faith, family, freedom, the state of Illinois, our nation, and conservative action. Here's David Smith and Monty Larrick.
Thanks for making Illinois Family Spotlight part of your day. I'm Monty Larrick. The Illinois Family Institute recently teamed with the group Restore Our Constitution for a special forum with historian David Barton. The event at the Decatur Conference Center drew over 500 people. Mr. Barton is the founder and president of Wall Builders. He's also the author of a number of best-selling books. Mr. Barton addressed a number of topics during his presentation, including the Electoral College and the move launched by the left to elect the president by a national popular vote. During this edition of Illinois Family Spotlight, you'll hear his comments about that, and then later we'll share what Mr. Barton had to say about daily Bible reading and Thomas Jefferson's efforts to abolish slavery. Yes, that Thomas Jefferson who owned slaves.
Electoral college is a big issue of debate today. So do we keep it? Do we dump it? Well, you really can't answer that. You know, Illinois is one of the 11 states that wants to dump it. So 11 states have passed legislation that says let's get rid of the electoral college. But you really can't answer whether you want to keep it or dump it unless you know some of the history about the electoral college. Why did they do it that way? No other nation was doing it that way. Why did we do it that way? And the answer is pretty simple. Now, the Electoral College itself is authorized by five parts of the Constitution. When they wrote the Constitution, they'd worked this all out. They went through all the debates. They knew what they were doing with choosing elections of presidents. And so there's five clauses in the Constitution that address the Electoral College and how it operates. Now, the original idea, when you go back to the beginning, what the Founding Fathers wanted at the beginning, their original idea was, well, let's let Congress choose the President of the United States. And that was part of the debates at the Constitutional Convention, and they rejected that idea for three reasons. They said, number one, we don't want this because too much partisanship. There's just 90 members of Congress. You have the 26 senators, and you have the 64 members of the House. 90 people, that's not a very big pool to be choosing a president from. It's real easy for partisanship to take over, as it did with Federalists versus Anti-Federalists. So didn't want to do that, and they said, well, we also don't want to do it because of foreign influence. If there's only 90 of us choosing the president, France, they can send in one of their agents to start bribing people, and then that can swing the election, so then our president becomes a pawn of a foreign nation. We don't want that. And they said, and we also think it violates separation of powers because we just created separation of powers. Now we're having one branch choose the head of the other branch. He'll feel like he's beholden to Congress, and we'll lose the checks and balances. And so we don't want Congress to choose it. Let's let the states choose it. No, we don't want the states choosing it either because then you lose federalism because there's supposed to be a separation between the states and the federal government. And if we let the states choose it, then you lose that. So you lose your separation of powers vertically, just like you lose them horizontally if Congress. People. No, we don't want the people choosing because they would do it by popular vote. And we don't. What's wrong with having a popular vote, which is the movement today? That's what Illinois joined in. Let's have the popular vote. Here's what was wrong with the popular vote. And what's wrong with it was well pointed out by one of the members who debated it, James Hillhouse. James Hillhouse comes from a little state. He comes from Connecticut. Why object to having a popular vote? Look what he says. James Hillhouse says, because Pennsylvania, Virginia, Massachusetts, and New York may combine, they may say to the other smaller states, we will not vote for your man. You see, there were 13 states, and four states had more than half the population. So four states run the United States. So a little state like Connecticut, where he's from, they won't ever get a choice of president. It'll always be the big states, always be the populace. So that's not really fair for the other people. They're going to be in their constitution, but they don't get any voice. It's going to be the big states that run it. And so taking all that together, they said, all right, none of these work, so what do we do? And that's where they went back to what Roger Sherman had done, because Roger Sherman said, well, and by the way, if you don't know, Roger Sherman is the guy who came up with the idea of bicameralism, that we have a Congress with the House and Senate. Prior to there, the Continental Congress was just one body. Now, we had two chaplains, but one body. But Roger Sherman said, let's have two bodies. Let's have one House and one Senate. And so what they did was they created a committee of 11 members at the Constitutional Convention, said, you guys, figure out a way to solve this. You figure out a way that we can choose a president that keeps everybody involved, that will have meaning. And so they did, and they went out and worked on it. Now, the bicameral part that they used, I mean, real simple, we got the House and the Senate, and thank you, Roger Sherman, for that concept. And by the way, bicameralism is real simple. It means that you have a House that represents the people and a Senate that represents the states. So you got the states and the people now both represented at Congress. And that's a pretty simple thing, the way it works. I mean, where you guys are here in Illinois, in the House, you have 18 members of Congress in the House. And take a state like North Dakota, it's got one member of Congress. They got twice as many senators, they got members of Congress. So you guys will crush North Dakota every single vote in the House of Representatives. It'll be 18-1 every time. Over on the Senate side, not quite the same. Over on the Senate side, North Dakota is just as strong as you are. North Dakota gets the same voice. The states get the same voice. So what we do when we pass legislation is we have to balance the voice of the states with the voice of the people. That's what every piece of legislation represents. It's not a popular vote piece of legislation. Otherwise, the House would win. If you don't know, last session of Congress, the House passed 700 measures last session of Congress. The Senate even refused to pick up. Now, I think that's a bad deal. I think Mitch McConnell stopped a lot of good stuff that should have gone through, but doesn't change the fact. You represent the states on that side, and you represent the people on this side. So you have to get some kind of a median in that before you can get anything to the president for him to sign. And I think the president's now signed 49 bills that have gone through the House and Senate so far. So James Madison explained it this way. This is in the Federalist Papers when they were explaining to the people exactly how this would work. He said, what we've got here, he said, the House of Representatives will derive its powers from the people of America, and the Senate, on the other hand, will derive its powers from the states. And so Alexander Hamilton went further in the Federalist Papers. He says, no measure can be approved without the concurrence of a majority of the people and a majority of the states. In other words, it's not going to be just a little group that passes something. You've got to have a big group in the House and a big group in the Senate before you can get anything passed. That's what it takes. So you take that principle of a majority of House and states, and that's what they said, hey, Electoral College, that's what we'll do. We'll use the people and the states like the House and the Senate. Let's do it just like that. So what happens is when you start looking on the Electoral College, in order to become President of the United States, you have to have a sufficient representation of the people and a sufficient representation of the states. That way everybody gets to be involved. So when you look at modern elections that we have, let me take you back to the Bush-Gore election of 2000. In the Bush-Gore election of 2000, if you remember the vote of the people, it was real simple. Al Gore beat George Bush by about a percentage point. Gore wins the vote of the people, but what Bush had wasn't a shabby percent. It wasn't like an 80-20% kind of margin. You had a lot of people who liked both guys. So when you then went to the states and looked at the states, it became a little more lopsided because Gore only had 20 of the states and Bush had 30 of the states. So with Gore getting 60, or with Bush getting 60% of the state vote and Gore getting 40%, that's pretty good trouncing by the states, which is why when you have that kind of a lopsided margin. So what happened here? Al Gore did not win. He had a good representation of the people, but what he did not have was a good representation of the states. George Bush, on the other hand, didn't win the popular vote, but he did have a good representation of the people. He had a significant number of votes, and he also won the vote of the states. He had representation of the vote. That's how he becomes president. Remember the next election was Kerry? Kerry couldn't do either one. He didn't have representation of the people. He didn't have representation of the states, so he wasn't even a competitive challenger at that point in time. Then you go to the election we just got through, 2016. We know what happened in the 2016 election. We know that Hillary won the vote by 2 percentage points. Now, it's not shabby to have 46% of the vote, but she had 48%, so she wins it by 2. But then when you look at the House, when you break the vote down by congressional district, Trump won 230 of the congressional districts. She won 205. So actually, Trump won the vote of the people, just not the popular vote. But if you break the people down by about 700,000 for each congressional district, scattered it out, but let's scatter it more. Let's go to the states. And the same thing, you had 60-40 margin on the states. And then when you go to the counties, Trump won 82% of the counties. Now, what happens is, so Hillary's problem was, yes, she had sufficient vote of the people. She did not have sufficient vote of the states. That was not what she had. And see, this is where the popular vote says, we don't care about the states, we don't care about the counties, we don't care about the cities. All we care about is one thing, popular vote. Now, the problem with that, and by the way, I'll just finish out with what Trump here, I've already said what happened. But the problem with that is it puts the urban against everybody else. Now, when you put urban against everybody else, there's a few things that are worth noting. One is there are 35,000 cities in America. 35,000. 20 cities have more than half the population of America. So 20 cities get to trump 35,000. That could be problematic. And what that means is you only need 20 cities to become president of the United States. 20, out of 35,000 cities, you only need 20 to become president. And if you're into percentage, that is 5 ten-thousandths of 1% of the cities is all it takes to become president of the United States. That doesn't pass the smell test. I don't think people are going to put up with that very long. You're going to have real trouble in a nation whether you have a small elite like that telling everybody else what's going on. So you got to take that in consideration, and that's what we did. So when you look at this urban versus everything else, you take those 20 cities, sure enough, she won Seattle, and she won Portland, and she won San Francisco, and Los Angeles, and San Diego, and she won Phoenix, and she won Denver, and you go over to Chicago, and she won Detroit, and she won Minneapolis, St. Paul, and she won New York, and she came down and won D.C., and won Baltimore, and came down to Richmond, won Richmond, and came down to Atlanta, and won Atlanta, and came to Miami, won that, and Tampa, St. Pete, won that, and New Orleans won that, and that's about it. That's how you get only 18% of the counties that you win, because you go to heavy population centers. Now, I may get in a lot of trouble here. I'm going to take a shot at it anyway. I'm just going to tell you history, tell you what's out there. When you look at the urban versus all else kind of stuff, founding fathers dealt with this back in their day. Remember, Benjamin Rush is a doctor. I didn't tell you that. Benjamin Rush, among his other credentials, he is called the father of American medicine. To this day, they still use his logo on medical stationery because he came up with so many medical cures. And I have his medical writings from 200 years ago. He says, well, we now know it. We now know that smoking tobacco causes lung cancer and chewing tobacco causes mouth cancer. 200 years ago, he had that. That's not the technology we've got today, but he was so far ahead in so many things. He's the first guy to come up with preventative medicine. You know, instead of treating people after they get sick, why don't we keep them from getting sick? You know, insurance companies have a hard time doing preventative medicine now, but it's a whole lot cheaper. And so he was so far ahead of so many things. This is what he said. He says, I view great cities as pestilential to the morals, the health, and the liberties of man. If you think that's a biased view, compare the crime rate of big cities with the country. Compare the unemployment rate of big cities with the country. Compare the gang rate of big cities with the country. Take any measure you want, take big cities and everybody else. He's right. It's a pestilential problem that we have. In the same way, he wrote to Thomas Jefferson, who had the same kind of opinion. I love his letter to Jefferson. To Jefferson, he says, I agree, he's talking to Tom, he says, I agree in your opinion of cities. Cowper, the poet, very happily expresses our ideas of cities compared with the country. God made the country, man made cities. Okay? There's more. He says, I consider cities in the same light that I do abscesses on the human body as reservoirs of all the impurities of a community. It's like a boil that comes up, you know. So they weren't fans of letting big cities choose everything, because then you lose the work ethic, the morals, the common sense, the other stuff. You want that to be part of the process of choosing. So current alternatives to that, well, it's what, and there have been 700 attempts to change the Electoral College. There's always the people who don't like the way it ends up. They don't like the results. It's a great system because it takes all these complicated things and puts them in the balance. So what happens, the current alternative is what's called the national popular vote. National popular vote, very simply, it's an agreement between the states that whoever wins the popular vote for the nation, all their states are going to throw their votes in behind it. So whoever you voted for as a state, doesn't matter, your votes are going to somebody else, even somebody you didn't vote for, if the rest of the nation chooses that person. So what happens with the national popular vote is you let a small, and by the way, right now, 9 states have the majority of the population. So you're letting 9 states tell 41 states what to do, which is what James Hillhouse talked about. You can't let 4 states tell 9 other states what to do. Now you got 9 telling 41 what to do. So when you look at it, what happens is even states that didn't vote for someone, they're bound by the will of the other states. So no longer do you have state identity. You now have to become what everybody else is. And I'll give you an example. In the election in 2016, Hillary won Washington, D.C., right? With 97% of the vote. Now, what do you think? Let's just say that Trump had won the popular vote. You think those folks in Washington, D.C. are going to be happy to find that they voted 97% for Hillary and all their votes now get transferred to Trump? Don't think you're going to have a happy city there. Not at all. Or on the other side, if you take Wyoming, because in Wyoming, 70% of people in Wyoming voted for Trump, not Hillary. Hillary won. You think 70% of the people in Wyoming are going to be happy to find that they actually voted for Hillary and not Trump when they cast their vote? you're going to have discontent all over the United States in a way that we've never even imagined. When people find out, wait a minute, that's vote stealing. They'll call it fraud, they'll call it, you know, ballot, all the stuff you hear about voter fraud now, you'll really hear it on steroids at that point in time. So what it does is it subjects one state's will to the will of all the other states, and that's never been who we are as a people. So the national popular vote takes all five clauses of the Constitution and wipes them out without a constitutional amendment. Just by virtue of a single statutory law, you wipe out five clauses of the Constitution. That's not a good way to go. It's not a good thing to do. You don't want it wiped out that way. So going back to what the founders did, the system they came up with is the best system that could be imagined, especially for a complicated nation like we have. If we try any other system, it's gonna blow up in a way that nobody wants. So dump it or keep it. I'm a fan of keeping it. You make up your own mind with it. But that's the reason it came to be. And once you know the history, then you can make a better informed decision whether you want to keep it or not.
Historian David Barton on Illinois Family Spotlight. We'll share his comments on Bible reading and Thomas Jefferson after this.
Hello, I'm David Smith, the Executive Director of Illinois Family Institute, a state-based Christian pro-life and pro-family public policy organization. I want to invite you to join us as we seek to be salt and light to a dark and rapidly decaying culture. You can do that in a number of ways. For example, you can join our email list to get timely alerts and great cultural commentaries. You can like our Facebook page, follow us on Twitter, listen to our podcast, and subscribe to our YouTube channel. You can attend one or more of the special events and forums we host in different parts of the state. We do all these things to encourage and equip Christians in Illinois. You see, we need you to help us fulfill our mission to boldly bring a biblical perspective to public policy. Our faith requires us to be bold, speak truthfully, and love our neighbors. Join us. Visit IllinoisFamily.org to learn more.
This is Illinois Family Spotlight, and on this edition, comments from historian David Barton from a recent forum in Decatur hosted by the Illinois Family Institute and the group Restore Our Constitution.
Finishing up from where I am, I was talking to you about John Quincy Adams, and John Quincy Adams, he was saying how important it is to read the Bible from cover to cover once a year. No book in the world deserves to be so unceasingly studied, so profoundly meditated on as the Bible. He said, I myself for many years have made it a practice to read through the Bible once every year. He says, my custom is to read four or five chapters every morning. And by the way, I want to address that for a minute. This guy spent 70 years as a public official. He was a state senator. He was a U.S. senator. He was 17 years in the House. He was a Secretary of State. He was nominated and confirmed to the U.S. Supreme Court. He's the President of the United States. He was a foreign ambassador to five different nations. This guy, all that time, would read 4 to 5 chapters every morning, 1 hour. He'd spend, that's a lot of time. But I'm going to challenge you. If you have never read the Bible from cover to cover, make a commitment tonight to do that in the next 12 months. I mean, that's just what used to be standard. And you don't have to do what he did. To read the Bible cover to cover does not take you an hour, does not take you 4 to 5 chapters. It takes you 3.2 chapters to do it. And with what we got today, with all the phone apps and all the Bible apps, I do this regularly. I have the Bible read to me every morning while I'm brushing my teeth and combing my hair and shaving and whatnot. 15 minutes. You can go through the Bible cover to cover. Everybody's got 15 minutes they can put into this. And so make the commitment to go through the Bible, 3.2 chapters a day, go through it. He said it's more enlightening than anything else. And he continued, he says, I've always endeavored to read, and remember he's talking to 10-year-old kids, he says, I've always endeavored to read it with the same spirit which I now recommend to you. In other words, 10-year-olds, listen up. Here's the way I read the Bible. Here's the way you need to read the Bible. He said, I always read it with the intention and desire that may contribute to my advance in wisdom and virtue. In other words, when I read the Bible, it is not a devotional book. I'm not looking to get blessed. I'm looking to find something I can apply. I want something that will change the way I think, my wisdom. I want something that will change the way I act, my virtue. I'm always looking for application, which is why I find science and business and medicine and all the things they find. You know, judiciary, they find it because they're looking for application. So if you do, God's got a great promise for us, Joshua 1:8. Joshua 1:8 says, constantly think about my word every day and every night, so you'll be sure to obey it. then you'll be prosperous and successful. The reason America has been more prosperous and more successful than any other nation is we applied God's word more than any other nation. Now, we haven't been perfect at it, and the more biblically illiterate we become, the less we apply it, and the more we pay a price for that. But the same with you. If you will get in God's word and apply it, you will be successful and prosperous. So will your family, so will your church, so will your community. That's just the bottom line key to all of it. Final quote I'll give you to challenge, to close out the evening, is a challenge from Thomas Jefferson. It comes from a book that Thomas, and by the way, it's inside the Jefferson Memorial, but it comes out of a book Thomas Jefferson wrote. First book he ever wrote was 1781. And inside the Jefferson Memorial is where you'll find this quote, and it's talking to the nation. And this is what he said: "And can the liberties of a nation be thought secure when we remove their only firm basis?" Now, I will tell you that Thomas Jefferson is also one of the five least religious founding fathers. That doesn't mean he's anti-religious. So he says, guys, the only way you can have national liberties is to know a firm basis. He said that firm basis is a conviction. Notice the word conviction. He said it's a conviction in the minds of the people that these liberties are of the gift of God, that they're not to be violated but with His wrath. He said, indeed, I tremble for my country when I reflect that God is just and His justice won't sleep forever. Now, your least religious founding fathers just said, listen up, folks. The only way you keep your national liberties is to have a conviction in your minds that these liberties come from God, and if you start screwing around with them, you're going to tick Him off, and then we're all going to be in trouble. Amen. That's your least religious founding father? By the way, that quote is in there. That quote was in the chapter of his book on why slavery is wrong and why it has to be abolished. He said, liberties come from God. And if you don't recognize that and free slaves, God's judgment, he predicted a civil war if we didn't end slavery. Now, we're trying to tear a statue down today because he's a slave owner. He was. Yeah, he sure was, because he lived in Virginia and state law would not allow him to free his own slaves. As a matter of fact, Jefferson went into the Virginia legislature, introduced the bill to abolish slavery in the entire state. Not just free his slaves, free every slave. The legislature voted it down. He went into the Continental Congress in 1784 and introduced a measure to abolish slavery in all 13 states. Missed it by one vote. He wrote, oh, that God would have changed one heart. We could have ended slavery. For 60 years, Jefferson led the crusade to end slavery and get equal civil rights. Today, he's one of the greatest heels that have ever been in American history. Why is it that black civil rights leaders across the generations, whether it's Benjamin Banneker, whether it's Frederick Douglass, whether it's Henry Highland Garnett, whether it's Martin Luther King, why is it they all praise Jefferson as a great civil rights advocate? It's because today we don't have a clue what our history is. See, because we don't, we get moved in directions that are inconsistent with anything back there. Yeah, Jefferson owned slaves voluntarily. No, he wished he hadn't. He wished he could free them. He was in debt $2.5 million. State law in Virginia not only made it hard to free slaves at all, if you're in debt, you can't free slaves. He couldn't get out from under it. That's why we have the Library of Congress. He sold his library to try to get some money because he was so badly in debt. And today, he's a racist bigot. Doesn't hold up. But his point is still made. Liberty comes from God. The only way a nation has liberty is to be convicted that those liberties come from God, and you cannot violate liberty without incurring God's wrath. So if you're interested in this kind of stuff, that's one of the reasons we did the book, The Jefferson Lies, because we know so little about what these guys actually believe today. But thank you guys for letting me share with you and share this stuff and share perspective on a lot of different things.
Historian David Barton will be sharing more of his comments from a recent forum in Decatur in the coming weeks. Special thanks to Pam Johnson with Restore Our Constitution for making that event possible. Until next time, God bless.
Thank you for listening to Illinois Family Spotlight. For more information, please visit us at ifiaction.org and look for us on Facebook and Twitter. If you would like to email us questions or comments, please do so at feedback@ifiaction.org. Until next time, stay engaged and keep your eyes on the prize.